In some NCAA basketball games, high school basketball games, there are people who try to play out the clock. And you both referred to time and the role of time as it relates to the Iran issue. And I was wondering if you could take it a step. Shaul, I think you said, you know, time is running out. Nick, I think you said we have time. How much time is there for diplomacy? And can you both be explicit? We hear a phrase, you know, big sticks, big carrots, big sticks. What does that mean explicitly? And Shaul, I have to ask you, if I don't know, I'm sure someone else will. You were quoted recently as saying war with Iran was inevitable. I don't know if it was a misquote or not, but I was wondering if you could elaborate on that and what that means for your belief that sanctions can actually work. So whoever would like to go first, Shaul, would you like to go first?
I would like to say that the Iranian double threat impact, one track is their nuclear program, and the second one is the fact that they are heading the radical group against the State of Israel and in our region. The link between Iran, Syria, Hamas, and Hezbollah is a very strong link. They support them by arms, money, and we see more and more footholds, Iranian footholds, within these areas, in Lebanon, in southern Lebanon, and in Gaza Strip. More than that, the Hezbollah is a proxy of Iran, and Iran is giving and transferring more and more long-range missiles to the hand of the Hezbollah in Lebanon. Today, the amount and the range of the missiles that the Hezbollah has are more, from the point of numbers, they have larger distance, and many types that covered most of Israeli territory. I believe that we should continue to do our best in diplomatic way to stop the Iranian nuclear program. But we have to say that all the options are on the table as a last option. I have to make it very clear. I believe that the main effort should be diplomatic effort. But what would you do as a Prime Minister of the State of Israel, knowing that the Iranian nuclear program is an existential threat against the State of Israel? And you have to be, and you have to make sure that Iran will not have a nuclear power, because I believe that the moment Iran will have a nuclear power, it will be a different world. And under the umbrella of a nuclear capability, they will deepen their terror activity against US, against European countries, against Israel, and they will strengthen the global terror in our life. So we cannot accept Iran having a nuclear power, but I believe that we should watch very carefully the way that the Iranians are buying time as a main strategy. This is the strategy since the last 10 years, and they are succeeding. And they are succeeding. And although we know that they have some progress in the last few years, we still say we have to continue the diplomatic track. But if one day the US intelligence, the European intelligence, the Israeli intelligence will come with a smoking gun and would say that the Iranian are successful and they already passed the technological issue and they are capable of having a nuclear power, what you suggest to the world, to the US, to the European countries, to Israel to do? I said it is an existential threat. It is unacceptable from the State of Israel view. And we should prepare for all options. And again, time is running. The Iranian moving ahead. And we should take all these issues in our consideration and in our thoughts and in the way that we are confronting the Iranian desire, a very high desire to have a nuclear power. Thank you.
So, Nick, and in your response, can you also relate to the impact on the balance of power in the region?
I'd be happy to. David, I think I'm going to leave to others an elucidation of this timeline. How much time is there left before Iran becomes nuclear capable? I'm not no longer with the U.S. government, so I don't want to make any prediction. But I would say this. Mohammed El-Baradei believes that there's time, and the IAEA, of course, probably knows more about the progress or lack of progress in Natanz than any other international body. So I assume that there's time left and there's diplomatic space for a diplomatic initiative to be pursued, and I do believe that the Bush administration, led by Secretary of State Condi Rice, is on the right track in emphasizing diplomacy, and I hope the next American president will have, as of January 20th, that option. He should have that option for diplomacy. I will say this, Israelis have a right to be concerned and reason to be concerned, given the vitriol hurled against them by Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. Given all the facts that Shaul Mofaz just presented to you, and I agree with his presentation of the facts. Iran is pursuing a game-changing nuclear weapons capability that will have deep and serious consequences for the balance of power in the Middle East. Israelis cannot disregard that. Americans can't disregard that. And so that's why I believe that there has to be a much tougher set of sanctions. If diplomacy is to succeed, it has to be combined with sanctions. Because diplomacy, again, provides a choice to the Iranians. And when the U.S. and Russia and China and Britain, France and Germany presented that proposal on June 1, 2006, the first big proposal for negotiations, it wasn't just a talk. It was a two-phase proposal. Let's have a diplomatic discussion, which Iran turned down in 2006 and in 2007 on multiple occasions. And if you can't do that, then we're going to sanction you. And the problem with the international effort to date is the United States has been serious, and certainly Israel has been serious, but many other countries have not. And they have not curtailed their economic interests commensurate with their geopolitical interests. And that's the challenge for Russia and China. And that's the challenge for the Asian trading partners and for the Arab trading partners of Iran. Last thing I'd say is this, and I think it's important to note this. There is no monolithic political environment in Tehran. There are individuals who are competing with each other, as best as I can make out, in a very uneasy balance of power within the Iranian government. and probably no identical set of views on how to move forward. There is the supreme leader, Ali Khamenei. There's Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. There's Ali Larijani, the new speaker of the Majlis. There's Ali Akbar Rafsanjani. There's Hatemi, the former president. There are lots of different individuals positioning themselves for the 2009 elections in Iran. This is a time to pursue diplomacy, to take advantage of any openings that might occur, not will occur, because no one can know that, but that could possibly occur because of the vicissitudes of Iranian politics and because of the non-monolithic nature of Iranian politics. And we ought to be sending signals, as I believe the United States government is trying to do, as I observe the U.S. government now on the outside, to say to them, there is an opening for diplomacy, but you've got to take it. And what's been infuriating, I think, for a lot of us is to see the Iranians equivocating when perfectly reasonable proposals have been on the table for a number of years now, for more than 2 years. And so I would say it again, the ball right now, today, August 1st, 2008, is in Iran's court. And Iran should take up this opportunity to talk.
Thank you. Right here. Go ahead. Get a microphone. Get a microphone here. And also make sure everyone has their cell phones off.
Hello, Michael Adler from the Wilson Center. Following up on this question of time, I want to ask Minister Mofaz, would Israel eventually accept some kind of enrichment capability from Iran as a form of compromise, because the official U.S. position is not one centrifuge spinning? And the second part of that question is, if Iran, for instance, produces by the end of the year enough low-enriched uranium to make enough highly-enriched uranium to make an atomic bomb, in other words, they had enough material, is that a red line for Israel?
What was the first question?
The question of whether Iran, in an eventual settlement, would be able to keep any enrichment capability. Would they be able to have centrifuges spinning? Would you agree to let them keep 3,000 centrifuges spinning? Would that be acceptable to Israel?
You know what? Given that we have all these questions, I'm going to have to take three at a time or else we won't get around to nearly anyone. So Barbara Slavin at USA Today. We'll do three and then
It's Barbara Slavin of the Washington Times as of 2 weeks ago. Just to clarify. Two questions. For Minister Mofaz. You're Iranian-born. You know a lot about Iran. You know a lot about the culture. Are you concerned that the kinds of remarks you've been making over the last few weeks and months only feed the most belligerent and paranoid elements of the Iranian government? And might it make sense to tone down the rhetoric a little bit? And for Nick Burns, do you regret that when you had the chance, when you were in government, the United States Bush administration did not more forcefully join the negotiation effort with the Iranians? I mean, it's taken all this time for an American to sit at the table simply to hear an Iranian response. Why weren't Americans there 2 years ago or earlier? Thank you.
And the last one in this round, John Alterman of CSIS.
Thanks. A question for Minister Mofaz. I'm wondering how you assess the Iranians as merely hostile or irrational, because a hostile Iran presumably can be deterred by the U.S. and by Israel, but an irrational Iran cannot be deterred. If Iran is irrational, what are the signs of irrationality in their actions that you can point to?
Okay, that's a good beginning. we can go to the podium.
I believe that the effort to have a dialogue with the Iranian, led by the European countries and the U.S., and the last meeting 2 weeks ago in Switzerland with a representative of the U.S., my colleague Bill Barnes, it is a right direction. But I believe that the time for the ultimatum that was given at this meeting should be limited. And it is about Sunday. And I cannot predict what will be the Iranian answer. Assuming that their strategy is still to buy time, they probably will say no. For buying time and passing November this year. And waiting for the next administration, US administration. I believe that if negotiation take place and will continue, the red line should be that there is no uranium enrichment on Iranian soil. Now, about the question of the time, I believe that we have to act in the very responsible way. When I said we, I believe Israel and the US, European countries, we don't want war. Israel don't want war. We want peace. But, as I said, we will not let that second Holocaust will take place once again. And we should estimate the situation each month, each week, every day, and to decide. So far, we believe that the main direction should be the diplomatic direction. How long? It depends on our estimation and leadership decision in the future. Now, about the Iranian people, I was born in Iran. I came to Israel when I was 9 years old. And believe me, the Iranian people are very nice and good people. They have an extreme regime today. I would like to remind you that 30 years ago, in 1978, the state of Israel and Iran has a very good relationship. We had ambassador in Tehran, a military attaché. We supported the Iranian to build their security industry. And see what happened 30 years later. This is the same people that have been the last 30 years in Iran. The same people. The only change is the regime. And we are facing today an extreme and hostile regime. The hostility is not from the Iranian people. It is from the Iranian leadership. And we have to emphasize on this point. So my answer to the last question about Iran is that the regime is hostile to us, to the world. And from my perspective, this hostility is not targeted only against Israel. It's targeted against the US, against the European countries, and the entire world. I would like to remind you that after the successful US campaign in Iraq, the wave of the terror activity that took place and still is in Iraq against U.S. forces was led by Iranian terror activity. Don't forget it. And I would like to give you a small story. We have a radio station in Israel. It is the name of the radio station is the voice of Israel in Persian. And they invited me from time to time to speak with Iranian people. Of course, it is by satellites. And I had the opportunity to speak with a taxi driver within Tehran. I was the chief of staff at this time, and I spoke with a taxi driver within Tehran. And he said, why? The first question or the second question was about the fact that I was part of the commanders in Entebbe operation, which took place on July 76. I'm older than you, David. However, he asked me, why you are not coming and rescuing us from this regime? Now you understand the differences between the people and the regime. Thank you.
But Joe, before you leave, just to follow up on John Alterman's question, do you think the leadership, and I'm not talking about the people, the leadership is not just hostile, but irrational, led by messianic forces? If it's rational, can it be deterred?
You can hear every day what Ahmadinejad is saying. And we are taking in a very serious way what is he is saying every day, every week. And I believe that he said what he said against the State of Israel and the fact that their goal is a full destruction of the State of Israel. We cannot take these statements knowing in an easy way, knowing that the state of that the Jewish people faced 60 years ago an attempt to destroy the Jewish people and to remove them from the earth. So we should be very careful, and we should take in a very serious way his goal, his attempt, and what he is saying about the destruction of the State of Israel.
And one more point before you leave the podium for a second. You spoke about the ultimatum on Sunday. What would you like the international community, if it's not the Security Council, then the United States or the Europeans to do if the Iranians do not accept the U.S. or the international community's proposals?
I believe that my friend Nick Barnes was very clear to this point. To put more and more pressure on the Iranian by sanctions. And I said in my remarks that we need in this year and next UN Security Council resolution.
Okay. Bob Lieber of Georgetown University. Or do you want to, or do you want Nick?
Do you mind?
Yeah, please, go ahead.
Ask me a question.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well,
that's right, go ahead.
I just want to agree completely with two things that Shaul just said. I think they're very important points. First is the Iranian link with Tehran and the nexus of Iran and Hezbollah in particular, and the pernicious influence that has on Lebanon, the nexus with Hamas, the pernicious influence that has on the moderate Palestinians as well as Israel. And so he was absolutely correct to say we cannot forget this linkage. We talk a lot about the nuclear challenge, and that is paramount. But the conventional Iranian policies that are sowing violence in the Middle East are also an issue that both Israel and the United States have to be acutely concerned about. Second, Shaul very vividly portrayed this huge disparity in thinking, maybe even in sentiment, between the government and many Iranians. I've had the same experience going on Radio Farda, the U.S. government's, when I was a government official, the U.S. government's Farsi radio program, and to talk to Iranians, who call us, by the way. We don't call them. And to witness the degree of disaffection that Persians have, but also non-Persians in Iranian society for this particular government is quite striking. Barbara asked a good question. What about the diplomacy? And John asked a complimentary question about whether or not we believe Iran is rational. We know so little about the Iranian government because of the separation that we've had for the better part of three decades. But I think it's fair to assume that even the Iranian government would pursue a rational course in its foreign and defense policies. And I think those in government and the international community can then counterposition strategies designed to take advantage of the disunity in the Iranian government and to perhaps separate some of the forces in Iran so that we can convince them that the only way to resolve this is through diplomacy and through negotiation. Now, Barbara asked, should the United States have been more aggressive in pursuing diplomacy in 2006? I would defend Secretary Condi Rice on this point. She broke with 28 years of American conventional wisdom when she put forward this proposal at the end of May, early June of 2006 for negotiations on the part of the Perm 5 countries in Iran. Not everybody in the United States agreed with her. There was a fair amount of press criticism of Secretary Rice, but she was right. She had the vision to see that there was a diplomatic opening and we should pursue it. And it's my appreciation now as an outsider that that diplomatic opening is still there. And it would be folly to give it up now, in my judgment. The last thing I'd say, and neither Shaul nor I have had time to mention this, let's remember, and this supports diplomacy and supports Secretary Rice, let's remember what's been put on the table by the United States, Russia, China, and the Europeans, not just an offer to have open-ended discussions. It was the kernel of the idea, it was President Putin's idea that the United States has embraced. We have said to the Iranians, an international consortium can be created. We can build civil nuclear power plants inside Iran. And the P5 idea is that nuclear fuel will be shipped in and the waste spent fuel will be taken out. Iran would not have access to the more sensitive aspects of the nuclear fuel cycle because it's not trustworthy. The Iranian government's not trustworthy. But this is President Putin's idea from 2005 and early 2006, which was then embraced by the United States and the other countries. This is a very good offer, and it takes away the excuse of Ahmadinejad. He says to the Iranian people, the West, the United States, is trying to deny us civil nuclear power. Absolutely untrue. He's not being truthful with the Iranian people. So I would defend, Barbara, the diplomatic strategy of Secretary Rice. I think she was right to do what she did in 2006, and she's certainly right to continue to pursue it now.
Okay. Bob Lieber, we'll do three on this round.
My question is for Nick Burns. I suspect virtually everybody in this room would agree with the points you've made about the importance of diplomacy, the desirability of diplomacy, the point that if diplomacy succeeds, it is the principal way of avoiding conflict or war. However, I want to push you about diplomacy. Virtually every American administration, beginning with Jimmy Carter, has in one way or another apologized to the Iranians for sins real or imagined going back to 1953 and since. The Clinton administration in particular bent over backwards quite conspicuously and publicly with various kinds of contacts. In addition, note that the Iranian nuclear program has been underway for more than 20 years. So my question is to ask you to elaborate on the diplomatic side. What is it on the diplomatic side that might make a difference in a context in which the Iranians by now should have a pretty good idea both about what carrots are available to them, but there's a lot of evidence that they are quite cynically playing out the clock, even if there is division among the various Iranian elites and leaderships. The problem is that the president and those around him, and even the supreme leader, seem to be fairly set in their determination to develop the nuclear option. A last point, if you forgive me for being professorial, but that's what I do. The notion of deterrence rests on the idea that your adversary is a value-maximizing, rational actor. Whether or not Ahmadinejad is rational is only part of it. The point is, if the regime is reckless, it undercuts a lot of the suppositions and requirements upon which deterrence would ultimately be based.
Okay, Ray Tanter, right up front. Yes. Got a mic?
Yes. Secretary Burns, I agree that Secretary Rice has done an outstanding job pulling the coalition together. This is Raymond Tanter from the Iran Policy Committee in Georgetown and the Washington Institute. I asked her at a Council on Foreign Relations meeting on June 19th, if you have said that Iran is the central bank of international terrorism and nuclear proliferation acquisition, why is not the central bank of Iran on the specially designated terrorist list with Bank Mellie and Bank Sederat? And her answer was interesting. She said that we know what Bank Mellie and Bank Sederat have done, setting up private banks to get around the sanctions, for example, but we don't have definitive evidence about the central bank of Iran. But I think, I'm not calling her disingenuous, or the answer disingenuous, I would never do that, but I think we do know that these other large banks are cooperating with the central bank of Iran. So I think Treasury and State at some point have to nail the central bank of Iran. Do you agree, sir?
Okay, and the third one in this round is Mehdi Khalaji, a fellow from Iran who's studied in Qom for many years. Mehdi.
Thanks to both speakers, but my question is for Mr. Nick Burns. Many people have spoken about President Ahmadinejad many times, and basically these negotiations are going on between Europeans and American officials and the people of President Ahmadinejad. I think the most powerful person in Iran, Ayatollah Khamenei, has been always ignored. And it is true that the political structure in Iran is not monolithic, and there are lots of tension inside Iran, but I think these old tensions may affect only Iranian domestic affairs, not Iranian foreign diplomacy, foreign policy. As we see, Ayatollah Khamenei has the final say on all crucial issue. He's in charge, directly in charge of all armed forces. He's in charge of nuclear program. He's in charge of Iranian foreign policy, and he's there. He wouldn't change by any election. Why we have possibly have any hope in a change in Iranian president? I think that if in next presidential election somebody else rather than Mr. Ahmadinejad will win, nothing will happen in terms of Iranian foreign policy. So I think that too much focus has been on Iranian president, but we haven't probably think how we can reach the most important person, who is Ayatollah Khamenei.
I want to respond to both Bob and Ray and their questions on diplomacy. I don't think there's any reason for the United States to go around apologizing to Iran. Not after what Iran has been doing in the Middle East, sowing terrorism, pursuing irresponsibly a nuclear weapons capability. And as I said before, I think that the mistake that we could make would be to continue to look backwards. The Iranians have a list of grievances from the early part of the 20th century onto the present, we have our own list of grievances. If we just engage in a diplomatic game of tit for tat and debate the history, that's all we'll do. And so I think you need to let historians look at that, and diplomats and policymakers and presidents and supreme leaders need to look forward and need to look for opportunities. And frankly, I think the Iranians owe the world answers. They haven't been as open with al-Baradei as they should have. If you read those IAEA reports that are published, they're filled with holes, literal holes, where the Iranians don't answer the questions that the international community, the United Nations, is putting to them. And that's why they've been sanctioned three times in the UN Security Council. So Iran owes us answers. And I don't think the proper way for the United States in the future to go around would be to apologize for the Iranians for this or that in the past. I think it's much better to say to the Iranians, we can have a relationship with you if certain things happen. Cease trying to become a nuclear weapons power. Change your policies towards terrorist groups in the Middle East. Those are American proposals that should be on the table. Now, the key question is, can diplomacy succeed? And the answer is, I don't know. And I think neither do any of you. But if we don't try diplomacy, and if we think that we can march off irretrievably towards war, then we risk the consequences, the unintended consequences that war always brings. And we've seen that in the Middle East over the last 5 or 6 years. And the prospect of a war with Iran at this time, when there's so much else that's occupying the strategic attention of the United States, I think we ought to give diplomacy a chance in a very tough-minded and hard-headed way and keep the ball in Iran's court. I would say this on the very good question, sir, that you've asked, that my own personal view, that there is a divided leadership in Iran, a divided leadership. And you're absolutely correct to say, I think most people would agree with you, that the supreme leader has the greatest amount of power. But we have seen differences, relative differences, between the last two Iranian presidents. Not that we didn't have severe differences with President Khatami. Ahmadinejad's statements are beyond the pale. His statements about the Holocaust, his statements about Israel are absolutely objectionable, and no member state of the United Nations should be allowed to make them, particularly from the Speaker's Bureau at the General Assembly in New York. And so one would hope that what would result from the Iranian elections in the spring of 2009 would be a different attitude and a different government, so that this prospect of diplomacy can be tested. But I agree with Shaul, very strongly agree with Shaul, it would be a grave mistake to take options off the table. The Iranians are more likely to listen to an international community, and particularly the United States, that is willing to entertain any option to serve the purpose of stopping the achievement of a nuclear weapons capability. I just think that the time has come for diplomacy to be pursued, but that doesn't mean you take any options off the table. That's probably the best way to get the attention of someone like Ahmadinejad.
Central Bank.
Central Bank.
Oh, I'm out of the government, and I would just leave questions like that to the Treasury Department, but Shaul said something at the beginning of his prepared remarks, and I agree completely with it. I agree with a lot of what he had to say. He said financial sanctions are the most important. And when we saw in 2006 and 2007 the series of French, British, and German banks either stop lending or dramatically reduce their lending, it seemed to me that got the most attention in Tehran. It wasn't just the state-to-state sanctions, and I've complained about those sanctions here. China is not implementing them strenuously enough. Russia is selling arms. But when the private financial community around the world began to shut down commercial lending, that's when the Iranians began to sweat. We need to see more of that. And governments in other countries can push their commercial banks to do that. Governments in Europe, governments in the Middle East, and governments in Asia. And that's where the action is. The United States is almost sanctioned out. And we have been for 3 decades. So other countries need to pick up that responsibility and march with us to increase the chance that diplomacy can be effective.
Okay. Do I see Hala Estefandiari, right back there? We're very happy he's back out of prison in Iran. So, Hala.
I'm Hala Estefandiari from the Wilson Center. This is a question both to Shaul Mofaz and to my colleague, Nick Burns, at the Wilson Center. Iran doesn't have yet a nuclear weapon, and it's a stable country. Iran's neighbor, Pakistan, has a nuclear, has nuclear weapon, and it's not such a stable country. And we also know that we have read that some of the intelligence element in Pakistan are supporting the Taliban. If there is a coup in Pakistan and the bomb falls in the hand of a government which will not be necessarily, you know, sympathetic or close to the United States, I mean, shouldn't Israel at this stage also worry about Pakistan and not focus only on Iran? And this is a question to both of you. Thank you.
Okay. Dan Williams of Reuters.
Thank you. This is a question for Minister Mufaz. Today you spoke of Syria as an ally, effectively a proxy of Iran. In the past, you've opposed the Olmert government's talks or expressed misgivings about the indirect talks with Syria, saying this is liable to bring the Iranians to Israel's doorstep should the Golan Heights be ceded. Given that today Israel's chief envoy to these indirect talks, Yoram Turbovich, I understand, tendered his resignation, given the political upheaval, the fact that Olmert's days are numbered, do you think the Syrian peace talks are over, effectively? And should you succeed, Mr. Olmert, as head of the Kadima Party, should you succeed him as prime minister, will you scrap these talks if they haven't been scrapped already?
Okay. Renaud Girard from Le Figaro. Here. Right up front.
This is a question for Nick Burns. I met Ali Larijani several times, and he told me, like you just told us, that we had to be creative, and that he wanted, this is what he said, to reassure us that they didn't want to make the bomb. For face-saving solution is very easy because the government of Iran says it doesn't want to make the bomb, that it's haram, it's against the Muslim convictions. And he said that we must find something new. Maybe we have not yet found the way. So I would like to have your opinion on a kind of international zone, like on the island of Kish, if you like, or in the Arvan province, close to the Shatt al-Arab, with international supervision, then, you know, the Westerners could enter without any barrier, where you could have a consortium of enrichment. Because when you say that the Russian solution is a good solution of Russia giving the fuel for this for the plants, electricity plants, the Iranians have actually a very good argument. They say that Russia has used in the past energy as a political tool towards Europe recently. Do you think that we could consider something to be creative, something considered like this kind of international zone with a consortium making this uranium and selling it to all the countries of the Middle East that want nuclear plants?
Because there's so many questions, if it's okay and we want to make sure we keep to our schedule of time, I'm going to allow a few more questions now, and then this way you can answer, each one of you can answer them. Sami Kabariti of the Jordanian Embassy.
This is a question for Minister Mufaz. Minister, in your opinion, how extensive and accurate is your intelligence information should a military strike on those Iranian installations take place? And also, in your mind, what sort of time frame are we talking about if you do carry out such, what sort of time frame do you need to complete such an operation?
Okay. The gentleman in the back, I've been waiting for a long time. How much time do you need for an operation?
With respect to the excellent presentation today,
please
one
introduce yourself too.
Yes, I'm Richard Hellman from CPAC and Merkle. With respect to the excellent presentations today, one whole avenue of approach has not been addressed, although we've said all options are on the table. That is the legal or juridical approach. A year ago, the House passed 411-2 H. Con. Res. 21, stating that President Ahmadinejad should be charged with incitement to genocide, a crime under the Genocide Convention and the UN Charter. Now, out of the Jerusalem Center for Public Affairs comes a 25-page document indicating exactly, with full vetted and peer-reviewed translations, what President Ahmadinejad and various ayatollahs and other civilian and military leaders have said, which calls in the vilest terms for the elimination of Israel and the Jewish people. We've spoken about avoiding another Holocaust. Is it time to consider the legal or juridical approach since a full indictment will soon be prepared in draft for any court that is ready and any nation or other party that's ready to bring a charge?
Okay, last two questions, Mr. Dana Marshall.
It's a question for Minister Mofaz. There's been a lot of discussion in this room about deterrence of the Iranian state. Are they rational, irrational? What are their values, et cetera? My question is, if we wake up on that unfortunate day when they do have a weapon, to what extent is Israel concerned about the possibility that such a weapon could either be sold, given, or stolen by terrorist groups? And how can that be? How could that be deterred?
And last question, Mr. Nabil Abunazaid from the PLO mission, the Chargé d'Affaires.
My question to Minister Mofaz. You talked about the double threat, one which I could understand, the support of Iran to Hamas and these groups. I think the answer to that is to have peace with the Palestinians. Mr. Burns said the Palestinians since 1948, they never had a day of justice. What is your solution? What do you think is justice for the Palestinians?
Okay, and finally, I'll just ask Shaul, each one of you will make concluding remarks, but Shaul, we have all these journalists in the room. I think on their minds is also the Israeli domestic situation. And I think it's only fair to ask you your assessment of the Kadima primaries and your strategy for victory on September 17th. Nick, you want to go?
I'll be happy to speak first so that Shaul can begin end with a crescendo on Israeli politics. I think Halas Fundiari, who's a remarkable woman, by the way, and it's been a great privilege to work with her at the Wilson Center, is right to focus on Central Asia as well. And I guess if I had to amend my own preliminary remarks would be to say that the Middle East is the epicenter of American foreign policy, and South Asia is not far behind in the challenges we have in Pakistan, in Afghanistan, and the more positive opportunity we have with India to build a true strategic partnership with India. I would distinguish between, and make a great distinction, between Pakistan and Iran. The problems of Pakistan emanate from the weaknesses within the country and perhaps the ungovernable nature of the part of the country that lies along the Afghan border. The problems with Iran lie within the sentiments of the Iranian political leadership and the policies of that leadership. And that's why Pakistan is a friend, and that's why the Iranian government is an adversary of the United States government, in my judgment. And I would make that distinction. Second, there was a very good question about creative diplomacy. I think that the P5 countries led by the U.S. have been creative. I don't think the Iranians have been creative. What have the Iranians been saying for two and a half years? No, in June of 2006, to negotiations. September 2006, when those negotiations were reoffered, no. September 2007, before the Heiligendamm summit, the G8 summit in Germany, no. What will their answer be now? Shaul and I have both said we hope the answer will now be yes, but there isn't a lot of room to think it will be. I think that the Iranians need to earn the trust of their negotiating partners. And so the effort is to get to the table with them, and then they need to earn our trust. They need to earn our trust through their actions in stepping away from a nuclear weapons capability. And last, I'd say about this issue of the House resolution on Ahmadinejad, it is surely objectionable that the leader of a member state of the United Nations can stand up and threaten the annihilation of another state, Israel. It is objectionable for Ahmadinejad to do that. It's also objectionable for him to say what he has said about the Holocaust. And I think any international response to that is definitely in order. Thank you very much.
So,
it's very difficult to answer if questions. And I fully adopt Nick Barnes' answer about the distinction between Pakistan and Iran. About the negotiation with the Syrian, I was asked a year ago by the Prime Minister in a Four Eyes meeting what is my opinion about such negotiations. And I said that we have to negotiate with the Syrian. But without preconditions and without deposit. The last meeting with the Syrian, the indirect meeting with the Syrian, was in the last week. My opinion and my goal will be to continue to speak with the Syrian without preconditions. I believe in peace, and for achieving peace, the way is peace for peace. And I will do my best to bring peace to the State of Israel. It is very important for the future of our country, for the future of our people, for the future of our son. More than that, one of the biggest achievements of the State of Israel in the last 60 years are the peace agreements with Egypt and Jordan. And I believe that we have to continue to strengthen these peace agreements with Egypt and Jordan, and to do our best to have peace agreements with our neighbors. Our first priority should be the Palestinians. But there are some obstacles, some problems. It is not an easy way. You have to remember that on June 2007, some dramatic and strategic event happened in Gaza. The Hamas took over. They fought against the Palestinian security groups, and they pushed them out of Gaza. A week ago, the confrontation between the members of the Fatah and Hamas continued. And we see a Palestinian entity with two heads. One is a terror organization, Control Gaza Strip, having more and more support from outside by the radical group, mainly by Iran, Syria, members of the Hamas, that their headquarters is within Damascus in Syria, having more and more rockets and Grad missiles, 20 kilometer, 22, 25 kilometer range. And their goal is the same goal of the Iranian, to destroy the state of Israel. At the same time, we have the PLO, the Fatah, controlling the West Bank. A Palestinian government, Abu Mazen leading this area. He's more moderate, and we have negotiation with him. And I believe that we should continue to negotiate with Abu Mazen and to support him by international support to have the power to control the West Bank and to fight against terrorism. The current situation is that Abu Mazen does not control, the Palestinian security groups does not control the Palestinian towns and the areas that are under their responsibility. And there is a long way to go until they will be capable of doing so. The security net for Abu Mazen and the Palestinian Authority for having a better future and the possibilities that he will be able to have a united Palestinian population under his leadership is to have a better economic situation. I believe that the economic situation is a main tool for the Palestinians to having a better life and a better hope for the future. But at the same time, we have to continue to do our best to have a peace agreement based on the roadmap elements that was part of President Bush's vision for achieving peace between Israel and the Palestinians. And I would like to refresh your memory about the roadmap plan. It said first the Palestinians should stop all terror activity, all kind of terror activity. And we don't see that this activity by the Palestinian security groups, we don't see a strong leadership stopping the terror activity within the West Bank. And the situation in Gaza is more dangerous. And it is under the control of terror organization. Terror organizations. About our intelligence, we have a good intelligence. Are we now 100% of the information that we want to know? The question is no. But we have a good intelligence. We share our intelligence with the US, which is our best allies. And this is an opportunity to thank the Bush administration for what he done in the last 8 years to support the state of Israel, to support the security of the state of Israel. And I'm sure that the next administration will follow this administration by the same policy. Thank you.
Well, I said at the beginning that it is very difficult to speak about if questions. So I hope that the Iranian will not have a nuclear capability that a terror organization will put their hand on this very dangerous issue. About the double threat, I don't see a direct link between the fact that the Iranian moving ahead by double threat impact. One is a nuclear program, and the second is the way that they are leading the radical group in our region. I would like to remember to you that the Iranians supporting the Hamas, which fighting against the Fatah and the PLO. Don't be mistaken. And we're speaking with the Palestinians, giving them our best support, and wishing for the day that we will be able to have peace with them. But the Hamas, at the same time, fighting, killing, pushing out of Gaza the Palestinian security apparatuses. So you have to see what is happening in our region in a very balanced way. And to end my remarks, I would like to say that in the last 60 years, the state of Israel faced a number of challenges, wars, terror attacks, and we have to give security to our people. This is the main issue in the state of Israel. We have been under attack by the Syrian, by the Hezbollah, in the past, by countries that we have a peace agreement with them, by the global terror, by the support of the Iranian to terror groups. And we have to secure our people. This is the first obligation of any leadership in any country in the world, to secure the life of the people and the future of your country. And I believe that we will continue to do our best to secure the state of Israel. But at the same time, we want to achieve peace. You cannot achieve peace without security. The policies that said peace first and then you will have security failed. We tried more than 3-4 times and this approach failed. We have to have first security and at the same time to do our best to achieve peace. And believe me, I was 36 years soldier in the IDF, including 4 years as a chief of staff. I know how painful is the war. And because of that, and because of the future of our people, our son, our daughters, we need peace in Israel. As a leader, this is my best wish to achieve peace for the state of Israel. As a father that has 3 children in the military, I want peace for them. I was 4 years
in addition, as a defense minister, in a very hard time. And I will continue to speak about the security of the State of Israel, and I will do my best to achieve peace with our neighbors. And finally, I was asked by my friend about the primary in Kadima. I believe that at the end of this primary, Kadima will win. And I hope that the best leader will be chosen by the members of Kadima to give the security, the peace, and to make sure that the State of Israel will continue to exist forever. Thank you very much.
Thank you.